From Uniontown to Lebanon, Erie to Harrisburg, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, it has been 4 years since Governor Tom Wolf shut down the state in the first of many missteps in dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. Guy Shiraki of the Commonwealth Foundation is here to talk about the lingering consequences. Governor Josh Shapiro is proposing a massive increase in state spending, but revenue trends indicate there likely won't be money to pay for it. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi have an Allegheny Institute report. And a proposed California-style cap and tax on energy production would devastate Pennsylvania's energy industry and raise consumer prices. Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania talks about it on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Guy Shiraki of the Commonwealth Foundation in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Changes to the election process in 2020 sowed seeds of distrust which linger. Now Speaker of the Pennsylvania House, Joanna McClinton, is proposing additional changes which could further compromise election integrity. Chief among her proposals is to allow same-day voter registration at polling locations on Election Day. Less controversial is a proposal to allow voters to cast their ballots in person at voting centers for the 2 weeks leading to Election Day. Republicans continue to press for a photo ID requirement, which has been successfully implemented in other states. Despite being a Philadelphia Eagles fan, Governor Josh Shapiro is supporting the Pittsburgh Steelers' bid to bring the NFL draft to the Steel City. Shapiro sent a letter to NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell urging the NFL to hold its biggest offseason event in Pittsburgh in 2026 or 2027. Philadelphia hosted the draft in 2017. Visit Pittsburgh, which fosters tourism development in the city, estimates the economic impact at between $120 and $160 million. The latest census numbers are out, and Pennsylvania's population continues to decline. The state has lost an estimated 41,100 residents since the 2020 census. South Central Pennsylvania, along with the Lehigh Valley and Pike County in northeastern Pennsylvania, show the largest population gains. Outside of Washington and Butler counties, southwestern Pennsylvania has seen a continued population loss. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Empty storefronts and declining student test scores are just some of the lingering problems created by the draconian shutdowns instituted by Governor Tom Wolf during the COVID-19 pandemic. Guy Shiraki is a senior fellow at the Commonwealth Foundation. He joins us now to discuss the ongoing impact. Guy, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Guy, one of the things about history is that it's often uncomfortable, it's often painful. You know, we've seen that with tearing down statues. People don't want to remember the bad parts of history, but it's very important that we do so so that we don't repeat the mistakes. So we're going to go back 4 years ago this week. We were in the middle of, remember this, 2 weeks to flatten the curve. It didn't work, and it unleashed a horrible series of events. And you recently wrote a column recalling what occurred. Want to tell us a little bit about your thoughts?
Loman, I appreciate it. I wrote a column in Broad and Liberty called Lies, Damn Lies, and 2 Weeks to Flatten the Curve, which is a takeoff on the old saying. I did it, and I write about it each year, whether on social media or being invited to go on the radio. I remember it because what you said, all that was done wrong, no matter how unpleasant, we have to remember. Because what was done wrong was so obvious to so many of us, but we weren't allowed to have the debate. And that's the dimension. Those two things is what's so important to me for us to remember going forward. One is a group of self-appointed experts told us there was only one way to deal with COVID, that they had all the answers. And furthermore, we weren't allowed to debate it. And what do I mean by that? Remember that all of these things were done by executive order. Many of these things were done by mandate and issues and declarations. There was no legislative debate. There was no election. There was no ballot question. There was not only no voter input, but the men and women we elected to the legislatures were not involved in the decision making. Prior to March 14th of 2020, almost no one in Pennsylvania knew that Dr. Rachel Levine was the Secretary of Health. We all learned of this person when Dr. Levine first walked to a podium, was introduced, and told us to shelter in place for 2 weeks to flatten the curve. So that's why I write about it. And the last point I'd make is this. It's not that you stand back and you say, oh, well, it's easy to say now. No, many of us, Guy Shiraki, Loman Henry, moms at school board meetings, other doctors, lots of people were raising questions. Not so much in March of 2020, but in April, May, June, and into 2021. We asked questions. We questioned whether the right decisions were being made. So this isn't looking back 4 years later and say, oh, those goofy people, we can make fun of them now. No, it's that common sense questions were trying to be raised then and weren't allowed.
In your commentary that you wrote, Guy, you talked about the fact that, and this is a quote from you, they crushed our economy with impacts still felt today in empty storefronts and inflation because they cost citizens their jobs, because they acted with arrogance and ignored common sense. I want to talk a bit about the lingering impact economically from all of the shutdowns that occurred and then all of the billions of dollars that were created out of thin air by the feds in order to give folks so-called financial relief from the fact that the government took away their jobs.
Yeah, as often is the case with the left, is they create a problem and then throw money at it. And if the problem isn't fixed, they throw more money at it, which usually makes the problem worse and then creates inflation. And COVID era was a perfect case study in that. They shut down, and particularly in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, Governor Tom Wolf pretty much led the nation. Pennsylvania closed too much for too long or was too slow to reopen. And it's important that we remember that, that what is a national problem of inflation is much worse in Pennsylvania. The empty storefronts, the inflation, the shrinking population that we have is worse than in many other states. It is a national problem. The nation has the sniffles, but we have the flu. We always get it worse because the left overreaches.
Another group that was significantly impacted continues to suffer the impacts of what occurred in 2020 and 2021, school students. And Guy, you are going to be one of the featured individuals at the upcoming Pennsylvania Leadership Conference. We're going to talk about that more at the end of the show here today. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference, of course, coming up April 4th, 5th, and 6th at the Penn Harris Hotel in Camp Hill. You're going to talk about education freedom. I want to talk for a couple of minutes about the impact of all the COVID shutdowns on students and some of the efforts you're undertaking to go out and help students recover from that.
Sure. Like so much else that happened during there were parents, there were doctors, there were psychologists that said what appears obvious to us. But in the panic of the moment, the experts, the quote unquote experts, stepped in. The Tom Wolfs and Rachel Levines of the world stepped in and said, we're going to lock away the kids. I mean, think of the irony. We encouraged 80 and 90 and 100-year-old people that were strangers to move into senior centers together. We took our most vulnerable people and forced them to live together. And then we took our healthiest, most vibrant people, our children, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, and locked them away from each other. And you didn't have to have a PhD in psychology to understand that keeping 7-year-olds and 9-year-olds away from their friends and away from their teachers was going to harm them academically and emotionally. But we said these things. Parents went to school board meetings, whether they were live or on Zoom, and said, when are our kids going back? When can they take their masks off? When can they resume activities? And in some districts, like our major cities in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, some of those children didn't see a live teacher for 18 months. 18 months. Take the poorest children, many of whom live in single-parent homes, many of whom don't have internet, keep them away from their teachers and classmates. What I like, sort of quote unquote, is to this very day, the New York Times just a couple of days ago did a big expose because all the smart people at the New York Times said, you know what? The schools that shut down the longest, Those kids have anxiety. Those kids have falling test scores. Those kids are sometimes two grades behind their classmates. And I get so frustrated and angry because that was so obvious. And how dare these experts take 4 years to sit in their lab coats and tweed blazers and stroke their chins to come back and tell you what any group of people at a Wawa or Sheetz would have told you standing in line waiting for coffee. You know, if you keep kids away from their teachers and their friends for 4 months, 6 months, or 18 months, you're going to hurt them emotionally and academically. So to this day, I continue to raise that concern that what we did was so obviously wrong. And again, we weren't allowed to question. You and I know that there were school board meetings live or on Zoom where parents would say, when can we open back up? And school board members yelled at them and said, what do you want these kids to die? Imagine having the arrogance, the hubris of yelling at a mom, asking the mom whether she wanted her child to die. No, the mom was asking a question. Loman, I live in suburban Philadelphia. Within 2 miles of my home, there is a Catholic school, an Episcopal school, a Quaker school, and several public schools. The Episcopal school and the Catholic school opened back up after a month. The public schools stayed shut for almost 6 months. I kept asking the question. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a chemist. I'm not a biologist. I kept asking the question, what are we doing? Either we're allowing the kids going to St. Norbert's and Episcopal Academy to risk their lives, or we're unnecessarily locking out the public school kids. It's 4 years later, and suddenly the New York Times says, gosh, the kids at St. Norbert's seem to be more emotionally stable, more academically prepared, and the kids at public school seem anxious, shorter attention spans, and their test scores are falling. How dare we have done this to our kids, and how dare we not work to fix it? One of the many reasons I'm for school choice is that when school officials make bad decisions, parents should be able to switch. Now, I live in a community where a lot of parents did take their kids out of the public schools that were closed too long, but they had the resources to do that. In many communities and many families, after you pay your property taxes or your local PIT, you don't have another $4,000 or $5,000 or $10,000. You've already paid that in property taxes. You can't afford to pay twice. How dare we trap kids in schools when school board directors make bad decisions? It's one of the many reasons I'm so passionate about school choice in all its forms, charter schools, cyber schools, or vouchers, or scholarships, because we have to empower parents. And COVID was a horrible example of what happens when school boards run amok and kids are trapped. They're emotionally challenged and their test scores fell. And again, like so much else, it was obvious to us with common sense. The experts did what they wanted, and they wouldn't allow debate. That's the shameful reminder, and we can't ever forget because we can't ever allow it to happen again.
Guy Shiraki, a senior fellow at the Commonwealth Foundation. Guy, tell us a bit about the Commonwealth Foundation.
The Commonwealth Foundation is a Harrisburg-based organization to offer conservative solutions to problems. It's not enough for those of us who are conservative to identify the problems, whether they're in education or energy or the economy. We have to offer solutions. So that's the Commonwealth Foundation's mission, to offer conservative solutions to problems that can be put into real life to make our real lives better. And I'm proud to be part of it, proud to write for them, and proud to help them advance their cause. And I'd encourage folks to go to commonwealthfoundation.org, learn more about our issues. And if there's an issue that is particularly important to you, share your ideas with us because you can be part of the solution as well.
Guy Shiraki of the Commonwealth Foundation. Guy, thank you for being back with us. Appreciate it.
I appreciate the opportunity and look forward to seeing you at the leadership conference on April 4, 5, and 6.
As we move away from the COVID pandemic, state revenue trends are coming into focus. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi have studied the numbers and show us the picture on this Allegheny Institute report.
Hello and welcome to the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is the Executive Director of the Allegheny Institute, Frank Gamrat. Your recent brief, which is available at our website, www.alleghenyinstitute.org, talks about the governor's budget proposal for the coming fiscal year and what recent tax collections and revenues look like and how that might impact the proposal. Can you give our listeners an idea of what happened with tax collections projections for the general fund in the most recent completed fiscal year?
Absolutely. The governor gave his budget address at the beginning of February, and he outlined basically $48 billion in spending. And while that sounds great and makes good politics, we asked the question, can you afford it? And when we looked at the most recently completed fiscal year, which would be 22-23, revenues came in at $44.92 billion. So a little shy of the governor's $48 billion. That represents a 6.7% decline from the previous fiscal year, 21-22, when the high of $48.13 billion was collected. So obviously the question is, you know, going forward, what can be expected? Now, what we do is we take the data, and you can get this data from the State Department of Revenue and their monthly reports, so that's easy to get. And we look at the three largest segments of the general fund revenue streams, and they are personal income, which is like 39% of the total, sales and use taxes 31%, and corporate net income taxes 14%. So those are the three major components of the total general fund revenue stream, and we wanted to look at them very specifically. Starting with the personal income tax, collections in fiscal 22-23 were $17.63 billion, and that was down almost 3% from the previous year when $18 billion was collected. And so there's your first sort of red flag, if you will, is that personal income tax is down in collections from the previous year. Now, when you look at just even the speed of this, what I mean by speed is we looked at 2013 through 2018, and we saw there was an increase in personal income tax collections of 23.7%. And then from fiscal year 2018-19, pre-pandemic, through the most recent 22-23, the increase was 25%. So it was a little higher in the last 5 years, just 1.3 percentage points higher. One of the things that we noticed in the pandemic, and I think everybody noticed, was that the federal government dumped a whole lot of money into the system to help stave off the effects of the pandemic. As a result, we had tremendous inflation, and a lot of things rose pretty dramatically in prices, including wages. You know, wage, of course, is the price of labor. And so a lot of the increase in the state's general fund collection had more to do with the federal government dumping money into the system, which caused wages to rise and personal income taxes to rise as well. And the same thing could be said for the sales and use tax. Of course, the sales and use taxes apply to any good or service in this Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and the tax is based on the percentage. It's 6%, at least statewide, and, you know, a little higher in Pittsburgh and some of the other counties that have home rule. You're seeing a lot of the increases to the general fund, and really since 21-22, it was all over $40 billion. Prior to fiscal year 2019, it was in the mid-30s. So you saw this large jump, which I believe is directly attributed to the federal government pumping money into the system. So let's look at the sales and use tax, knowing that information. Fiscal 22-23 was just $14.02 billion, which is roughly the same as the previous fiscal year, $14.01 billion. So you're seeing that flattening out. And of course, in the last year or two, the Federal Reserve System has done a great job of ratcheting down inflation by raising, of course, the interest rates that are out there. And we're seeing inflation cool down a little bit recently, and that's being reflected, I think, in the reduction in the personal income tax and, of course, the flatness of the sales and use tax. When you look at the last one, the corporate net income tax, there's a little caveat here, and that is the rate had been changed. And we did this brief back in 22. We had one of the highest net income corporate net income taxes in the country at 9.9% in 2022. It had been dropped by that legislation to 8.9% in 2023 and then 8.49% in 2024. So it has been gone down over this study period and is likely to continue to fall to 4.99% by 2031. So the corporate income tax, which was at 8.99% for the 2023 portion of the fiscal year, realized $6.14 billion, which was up 15.4% from the previous fiscal year's $5.3 billion, when the rate the entire year was 9.99%. So they cut the rate, and instead of the corporate income tax falling, it actually had gone up. Now, again, some of that may be due to higher profits with inflation and prices of products going up. but we ended up collecting more. And again, prior to the pandemic, the growth was pretty decent. It was 35.8%. But since the pandemic, corporate net income tax from fiscal 18-19 through fiscal 22-23, it accelerated 81%. For point of reference, the inflation rate, you know, we looked at the Northeast CPU, the inflation rate from 2018 through 2023 was 18.3%. So all three of the major components of the general fund revenues exceeded the rate of inflation. We had been doing well, and I think that's a large part of why the governor was so ambitious in his budget. But now we ask the question, okay, let's look at the current fiscal year. And we have the first 6 months data that goes from July 1st of 2023 to December 31st of 2023. We have that data available to us. Now let's take a look at how those collections for those main components have done. And what we're finding is mostly flat. Total general fund revenues are just less than a percent, the 0.74% ahead of what it was the previous fiscal year, 22-23. Sales and youth tax up just 0.72%. Partial income tax up 0.69%. And so you're not seeing a tremendous growth in total general fund revenues. Corporate net income taxes are actually down slightly, 0.7%. My guess is it's likely not going to be much greater than that when this fiscal year is completed, and we're not going to have the funds to fund the governor's $48 billion wish list in this current budget.
As we sit here in March, and like you said, there'll be data that will come in, and obviously there's going to be budget deliberations going on in Harrisburg until the start of the fiscal year in July. What do you recommend that the state do? I mean, they have a budget proposal, and the legislature has going on with its meetings right now, and going over the various proposals, and what do you recommend happen?
Well, and that's just it. You know, the governor's lamenting that we're not competing with, Pennsylvania's not competitive with our neighboring states. Well, heck, not just neighboring states, you know, Ohio, New York, New Jersey, but they can't even compete with southeastern states. And a lot of it has to do to the fact that historically, Pennsylvania has not been a business-friendly state. It's heavily dominated by the unions. We'd like to see the right of teachers to strike go away, or the right of transit union workers to strike go away, and I think that'll start adding some sanity to spending at school districts and mass transit areas. And you have also these little regulations like a regional greenhouse gas initiative. While that at the state level is in limbo, possible that that could be inputted into smaller areas like at manufacturing or even transportation. So those are the types of regulations that really tell businesses, hey, you know, you're not welcome here. And so they are going to South Carolina, Georgia, and North Carolina.
Great stuff as always, Frank, and we always urge our listeners to visit our website, www.alleghenyinstitute.org, to read this brief and others. For Frank Gamrat, this is Eric Montardi, and this has been the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
Governor Josh Shapiro has proposed a California-style cap and tax on energy production that would dramatically raise consumer prices while crippling the state's energy industry. Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania explains on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
President Biden and Senator Bob Casey decided it was in our best interest to close the nation's pipelines. Our entire economy, specifically the value of our dollar, is based off energy production. It lends itself to the question, are these leaders unaware of the impact that their energy policy has on taxpayers? If they are, this should send a chill down the spine of every Pennsylvanian. Just last week in the Commonwealth, Governor Shapiro proposed bringing Gavin Newsom's California-style hammer down on Pennsylvanians with more cap-and-tax policy that would further obliterate Pennsylvania's economy by taxing out of existence what production we have left. Keep in mind, these policies don't just affect oil, natural gas, and coal companies. Rather, they affect the companies that use the resources to produce goods, the trucking and rail companies that ship them, the mom-and-pop store owners who sell products, and ultimately, you, the consumer, who pays the taxes incurred by all of the aforementioned. To be blunt, the governor intends to fight inflation by creating more artificial inflation. Both the administrations in D.C. and Harrisburg have set these crushing energy policies in the name of climate change. Of course, we all want clear water, clean air, and healthy forestry, but we can certainly have all of these things while still being able to purchase the fuel and energy to travel to work or to heat our homes. Our government seems to believe that they can solve the world's problems by throwing thousands, billions, and even trillions of dollars at the problem. However, we know that that has detrimental impact on the taxpayer, who ultimately bears the burden of greater taxation and inflation. Federal and state governments should start with the basics. Make the permitting process straightforward, without unfounded interference from bureaucracies like the EPA or the DEP, who can simply put permits on a desk for years on end with the sole intent of slowing production. In Harrisburg, the legislature should intervene on state cap and tax policies such as the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. These so-called treaties only siphon more of your hard-earned tax dollars into a never-ending spending machine of bureaucratic nonsense. We'll start with the bad news first. President Joe Biden and Governor Josh Shapiro remain out of touch when it comes to their approach to energy policies. But here's the good news. Tens of thousands of Pennsylvanians have joined our coalition to fight back against big government interfering with our energy production and consumption. Hundreds of concerned activists each day scale their voices because they know that prosperity is possible and it can be achieved through common sense free market reform. Here's how we do it. The first, by minimizing government influence, reduce government control over our lives, and foster an environment of self-reliance and individual empowerment. Number two, we promote affordable energy for all. Washington and Harrisburg need to recognize the strain of energy costs on families and aim to create policies that ensure affordable energy solutions accessible to every household. We can achieve this through accountability measures. And three, remove restrictions to domestic energy that limit supply, drive up fuel prices, and hinder our overall economic growth. We need a drastic change in approach towards energy policy here in the Commonwealth, one that allows for energy innovation. This radical push from Biden, Senator Casey, and Governor Shapiro will do nothing of the like. Now is the time to fight back. Head to prosperityispossible.com to encourage Washington and Harrisburg alike to hear the concerns of Pennsylvania's residents. Again, head to prosperityispossible.com to scale your voice to Washington. This is Emily Green, Deputy State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, lincolnradiojournal.com and lincolninstitute.org. The 2024 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference, well, it's now less than 2 weeks away, April 4th through 6th at the Penn Harris Hotel and Convention Center near Harrisburg. We are pleased to announce that Vivek Ramaswamy will be joining Dinesh D'Souza as featured speakers at this year's event. The 2024 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference speaker lineup will also include John Gizzi of Newsmax, political commentator Mary Catherine Hamm, Congressman Scott Perry, U.S. Senate candidate Dave McCormick, Heritage Foundation President Kevin Roberts, and many others. The three-day event will also include an expanded schedule of workshops. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is the nation's largest and longest-running of the state-based conservative activist conferences in the nation. Get complete details and register for this year's Pennsylvania Leadership Conference at paleadershipconference.org. That's paleadershipconference.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.